Welcome to the deep dive. I'm Paul. That gentleman right there is Ian Boyd. And we are going to get into something that all of us want to talk about, which is what is the best upside case for the 2025 Texas Longhorns football team? What is the optimist's case for Texas? Ian and I tend to be realists. I wouldn't say we're pessimists, but if anything, sometimes this show, we throw a little cold water on some of our more fanciful notions. But on this show, we're going to talk about what it looks like if everything goes right. So I'm going to give you the opportunity right now to text, call, reach out to all of your friends, all of your Longhorn fans, and tell them to tune into the show because this is the show that they all want to hear if they want the burnt orange Kool-Aid. And if you want the best possible talk about the Texas Longhorns, nay, college football and sports in general, you need to join Inside Texas. $1 until April 30th or August 30th. I wish it was April 30th. That would be an incredible deal. $1 gets you membership until August 30th. That's the kickoff for the Ohio State Buckeyes. And new members only, of course. Hey, guys, it's the best conversation about the Texas Longhorns and about sports in general. Also, there's a ton of fun on the board. A lot of ribaldry and magpieing and tomfoolery is also part of that conversation. And then, if you want the best no-nonsense preview of the mighty Texas Longhorns and the entire SEC and every Longhorn opponent, you need to buy the 2025 Longhorn Football Prospectus, Thinking Texas Football, written by yours truly. This is the 13th annual edition, and it is over 61,000 words, 150 pages in the written edition. And you can go buy that at Amazon right now for the paperback, or you can go to Smashwords or Apple for the e-versions. We've got links down in the description. Folks, if you're a diehard Longhorn fan, this is indispensable. It is the burnt orange Bible. Let's get real about the 2025 Longhorns. So Ian and I, as I've said, we tend to be, I'd say, a little more realistic, occasionally bordering on cynical. And I would say that one of the things that we need to do as a remedy to create a little balance for this deep dive, Ian, is we want to adopt the perspective of, hey, what if everything went right for Texas? So this isn't necessarily what we're predicting will happen, but we're saying within the bounds of the bell curve of probability, these are things that could happen that are realistic. What would it look like if a bunch of things came together for Texas in 2025? What would those things be, and what might it allow this team to become? Ian, does that sound like a fair premise?
Yeah.
Let's get started. Talk to us about this first bold prediction about the quarterback of the Texas Longhorns.
This is probably the one I feel the best about. Is I think Arch is going to be everything he's hoped and prayed to have been for Texas. Getting him in his first start in his third year, I think, is going to make a difference. I think if he played last year, he would have been really good, but he would have had more growing pains. And he had a couple of moments when he did play where it was like, whoa, there's a young guy right there. I remember, I'm not going to name who, but there were some media figures in the Texas sphere last year that thought all the fan excitement about Arch was really dumb and that Quinn was awesome and that all the fans were just totally not appreciating what they had and pining for the next thing. And when Arch made a couple throws and decisions against like ULM, some of those people were like, see, like this guy can't play. He can't start. But anyway, that aside, I think he's going to be outstanding this year. And if he is, that can have downstream effects across the entire offense.
So the reason we led with him is not just for the algorithm, which we cynically exploit, Arch Manning. But also because we actually think this is the necessary precondition for Texas to achieve the very heights of what it's capable of. If Arch isn't the man, then a lot of this other stuff won't matter as much. It'll give Texas a lot of floor. We'll be a pretty good football team. But yeah, we are not going to win it all. And however you want to define win it all, the SEC or the national championship and the playoffs, we're not going to win it all unless Arch Manning is the dude. Fair?
Yeah, unless number two is even more true than we think.
I would say even then. I would say that if Arch isn't really good, then I don't think all the other stuff is going to matter in terms of reaching the ultimate potential of this team. Am I putting it too much on number 16, or do you think that that's fair?
I think you are. But let's get into number two so we can maybe that'll make it easier to.
Let's get into number two. Players level up. So one of the things that I do mention in this here pamphlet is the fact in my opening introduction, I basically talk about the very clear improvement that Texas has made under Steve Sarkisian. All of us know it, right? 5-7, 8-5, 12-2, 13-3. All of us know what the NFL draft has looked like since 2021. 0, 5, 11, 12. I'm not a genius, but I see a trend there. And what's happening is something very unique that hasn't happened in Texas in a while, and now it's happening big time. Players are getting developed. So what's happening, Ian, is that we're getting in these great recruiting classes. And then, of course, we immediately forget about all those guys because they don't all immediately go on the field, right? Except a small handful of them.
And more than used to, it feels like.
That's right. And then we assume, based on the Tom Herman, Charlie Strong, end of Mac Brown days, that a player we haven't seen in a year or 2 years must be exactly the same player or worse than the guy we remembered as a freshman or as a recruit, a senior in high school. In fact, what we're finding out is all of those guys are leveling up. Every single guy is getting better at football, including the guys that we think of as starters that we think we know. So Jalen Gilboa, he's been playing at Texas for 3 years. We know exactly what Jalen Gilboa is. If you grade him, he's been very similar. You know what everyone's talking about this offseason?
Jalen Gilboa
leveling up and suddenly displaying traits and athleticism that he hadn't displayed before. So there are countless players that we could talk about within this regard. I'll throw out a few. Kobe Black, Jelani McDonald, Derek Williams, Wingo, Baker at tackle. All of these players could level up substantially. Are there any that we need to talk about or any you want to dive into specifically in this respect?
There's a few. Also, here's a question. How many would have to level up for Texas to be a champion, and how many would have to level up for Texas to be a potential champion, even if Arch isn't quite what we expect?
Question one, a half dozen. Question two, double digits.
Yeah. But possible on number two.
Very
good. Let's just go through some guys that I think could level up that would make a huge impact. Colin Simmons.
Yeah.
Colin Simmons was simply a raw speed rusher last year. He barely knew what he was doing. If he levels up in the same way that Anthony Hill did from his freshman year to his sophomore year, then Colin Simmons becomes like Von Miller level destroyer of worlds. Ethan Burke. I'm not at all convinced that Ethan Burke is that we've seen the end of his growth, right? Kobe Black, Jelani McDonald, Derek Williams, and you all mentioned, those are all essential. Either those three or some other young guys, in secondary Gilbo, all have to level up for either scenario. But they have a lot of guys that could, right? That's just on defense. On offense, I think Baker, Goosby could get a lot better.
Yes.
Trey Wisner could add weight and be better and make you and me both look kind of dumb.
Cole Hudson.
Wingo kind of has to.
Christian Clark, huge X factor.
There's a lot. CJ, there's a lot of running backs. Almost all the running backs fit in this classification. So if Texas has a really high hit rate of these guys all getting meaningfully better in this offseason, then a lot of our concerns look dumb, and even some of the Manning focus that we've had starts to lose a little bit of bite because they just become an overall overwhelming juggernaut.
Well, and consider players that we're not even expecting to carry the main load improving and what that marginal improvement can mean. Zena Umiozulu. the offseason practice reports, and this is one of the reasons you need to be joining Inside Texas, Eric Nalin was asking very specific questions about who's got the best get off. And they're like, well, Colin Simmons, duh. Who's number two? Zena Umiazulu. At 6'5", 260, every time I see or hear about him, they're like, I think he added another 10 pounds just looking at the weight set. And he's still retaining all that athleticism. Ian, we're not expecting him to start. We're expecting him to give us 15 hard snaps a game. But what if those 15 hard snaps are at a really high level? Like, you just level up incrementally in so many little areas that suddenly the aggregate of your football team becomes very good. And so that's what Ian and I are talking about when we're saying players level up. That seems kind of an obvious thing to say. But what we're seeing is that Sark is consistently leveling guys up in this program. And that has been his greatest attribute at the University of Texas. It's not this, he's an offensive play calling wunderkind. He's actually created this amazing developmental crockpot for his football team where people get put on simmer and they just keep getting better and better and better over time.
It's a classic reload versus rebuild deal.
One of the questions that I've been asking for years in this year book is, we'll know we're no longer a Big 12 team, and we'll know that we're no longer even a typical SEC team, and that we're one of these elite juggernauts in the top three of the country every year, when we go from basically rebuild to reload. Because prior to Sark, we were subject to developmental cycles, just like 97% of the teams in college football. You get that great class, as they level up, your win total levels up. But then when they graduate, that's when your head coach goes and tries to find another better job, right? Because he knows the reckoning is coming. Think Sonny Dykes at TCU after that national championship run. Texas is defying that developmental cycle that we're familiar with from the Big 12, Ian, or from, frankly, most of college football. We've defied it. So this year, if we do it yet again, you just have to have faith and confidence that it's just going to keep happening every year. You know a guy that you got to have faith and confidence in?
I do.
Your mortgage guy, Ian. I know that's the first thing that leapt into your mind, just like our viewers and listeners. And this is the mortgage guy you need to call. This guy can't level up anymore. I think he's still trying. I don't know if it's possible because he's reached the apogee of his profession, the very zenith of the mortgage broker world. That's Gabe Winslow. You can reach him at 832-557-1095. Why am I so glowing in my praise for Gabe Winslow? One, he's promoting and supporting the show. We love that. We love people that love us, Ian. But also, the testimonials. Go read his Google reviews. Go read the Inside Texas board when we put up a deep dive. People, unprompted, will all the time say, hey, I called Gabe. This guy's absolutely fantastic. He is sharp as a freaking razor. He is hardworking. He is on it. The minute I start to have a question about my mortgage or my deal that we're working on, he calls me and he's got three anticipatory answers that address everything I wanted and even some factors I didn't even know were a factor. This is the guy you want in your corner. If you want to go with the best and you are the best, associate with the best. Fly with the Eagles, Ian. That's Gabe Winslow, 832-557-1095. All right. An area where we have not been flying with the Eagles last year, at least, where we had been before, with special teams. Ian, our special teams were kind of a beating last year.
Yeah. They were, it was pretty bad. That they lost Georgia because of special teams. They lost the SEC championship because of special teams. I thought, and I've said that Georgia kind of took it to Texas in a few different ways in that game, but Even with that, with good special teams, Texas probably wins that game, right?
Yes.
They got victimized by two fake punts in a row almost. Two games later against Arizona State and Georgia. The big one we all remember is that they missed all those field goals.
Yep.
I'll tell you, that first Georgia game, I was there in DKR. And when they were struggling on offense, every time, and it was like, okay, well, time to punt. And be like, well, they would just not get anything out of the punt. And Georgia would be in prime position immediately, over and over again. They were. You have the stats. I believe they were only good in one regard of special teams. But you tell us the full story.
Yeah. From the prospectus, Ian. Thank you for the setup. And of course, I turned to the wrong page. Kickoff coverage. That's been uniformly excellent under Jeff Banks. Last year, Texas was in the top 15 nationally. Opponents averaged only 16.57 yards per kickoff return. The longest of the year that we gave up was 28 yards.
That's great.
That's exceptional. Yeah. That was the only area of special teams in which we excelled. Otherwise, in advanced metrics, we were the 34th ranked special teams unit in the country, which to me actually seems high. But we were top 10 the first 3 years under Jeff Banks.
I think FBI has it even worse.
Told you FBI.
Oh, 34. Really? Maybe yeah. I think SP Plus had it like 100th or something.
Yes. They're looking at different stats and they value different things. Right. Jeff Banks was not happy with his special teams performance. He's aware of this. He wouldn't be angry at us mocking his special teams at all because he knows it. He's furious about it. Our kickoff return was awful. The worst I've ever seen at Texas, and not just in terms of personnel or anything like that. Matthew Golden was actually quite good at kick returns at Houston. It's that we didn't block anyone, and our scheme was terrible. So Banks is aware of this. This is going to get addressed. We also brought in two different kickers. Mason Shipley from Texas State. He has been good in a football game from over 60 yards. He drilled a 60-something yard field goal against Sam Houston State. And then he's just been very reliable. And then we brought in Jack Bomeister, the punter from Utah.
Yeah.
So clearly our coaches saw special teams as an urgent thing to be fixed. And they didn't sit there idly and just pray that it would get better. Any thoughts, Ian, on our improvements?
Just to take a victory lap. I wrote an article at one point last year that was like five greatest transfer portal needs, positional needs.
Yep.
I said punter.
Yeah. We were both.
I know this is boring, but it looks like they're counting on a freshman. Let's not do that. Get a guy out of the portal. They didn't. It is worse than that. I mean, other things went wrong too. Sideshow Burt went totally sideways, stepped on a bunch of rakes. But yeah, this was worth between like a field goal and a touchdown and multiple close games for Texas. And like, point in for sure points or expected points, maybe more than that actually in some of them. I mean, they missed a bunch of field goals you would expect to make.
Well, and the angst over your field goal kicker changes your decision matrix on offense, right?
I mean, I kind of helped though probably, but
well, once you resign yourself to the idea of we can't trust this guy, but that happened late.
Yeah.
So once you start going for it on 4th and 2 on the opponent 30-yard line, that actually helps your outcomes. That's what Ian's suggesting. What I'm saying is it took us about 12 games of pain to get there and have that realization. And we didn't really act on that until Arizona State. So I think it's something that we're going to have a much clearer decision matrix of where are we good with Mason Shipley? By the way, if your guy can theoretically hit from 60, it's a nice thing to have in your back pocket on a nice winless day where you're driving for a final score, you know, for end of the first half, and you're on the opponent 35 and you've already entered scoring territory. That's pretty cool.
That's a big one in like when you're in the swamp and when you're in Columbus, and when you're in Dallas. By the way, what are the times to kick field goals? I would say inside the 10, never kick a field goal unless it's the points and unless the points will make a difference in the number of possessions left in the game is such that you take the points. And otherwise, I would only take it if I'm like in good range of the kicker and deep up to his effective range.
Yeah. So the close, if it's goal to go, but it's, you're on the 10, fourth and 10.
Yeah.
I'll kick that.
Because I still might go for that. I still might.
Yeah.
Go for
your outcomes, if you just kind of do the math and not act out on what's actually happening in the game, that's probably a good outcome more often than not. But yeah, I mean, I'm with you. I'm a go for it guy. You know, fourth and two on the opponent 30. I'm trying to go score a touchdown. I'm not trying to kick a field goal that has a 70%, 60, you know, if you're fortunate, a 60 or 70% chance of being made. So, and then otherwise I like long bomb field goals, like end of half possessions. If you have an opportunity to try a 58 yarder and there's no real consequence for it, like the clock's going to expire after, you're not giving up field position. Bombs away, baby. Let's go.
And you're not at risk of the kick six or something like that.
That's right. Yeah, you don't want to do a Nick Saban situation there. I would also say the punting, you touched upon that. The real value of us upgrading roster talent is our punt coverage is very good. So one of the ways you can really help your punt coverage is don't outkick your coverage. If you've ever wondered where that expression comes from, it's a football expression. And it means literally, yeah, your punter can kick a line drive boomer that has no hang time. It's like basically a spiral that shoots out and it goes 50 yards, but your coverage guys are halfway down the field. The punter fields it cleanly and he's got multiple lanes to go. You know, so your punter might be really excited. I had a 51-yard punt. Yeah, they had a 38-yard return. You know, what matters in punting is net. So if you kick a really high, beautiful punt that hangs in the air for 3.8 seconds and it lands and it's fair caught and you only punted it 43 yards, that's a great punt.
Yep. They were not good at punting last year.
No.
If it was long, it was past the coverage or it was into the end zone. If it was high hang time, it was short.
It was 35 yards.
It was, ugh.
Yeah.
It's bad.
Yeah, those little hidden yards do add up over time. And not to sound like we've only been in the SEC a year, but now I'm going to sound like an SEC guy. The margins are small in the SEC. And you're not going to play your best every week. And it's very helpful. You know, now coaches will say, old school coaches, special teams, that's one third of the game. You know, they're not one third of the game.
No.
But you know what they are? They're about 15% of the game.
Do you remember? I remember you noting this about the 2011 LSU Tigers.
They were, wow! What a pull!
I got a great Rolodex.
I can see
plenty of Paul Wadlington columns in the archives. The 2011 Tigers would really hammer teams with special teams. They were generating points on special teams all the time. They were getting margins. And they were not even that good of an offensive team. It was like classic Les Miles bully ball.
Yeah.
Rocket pitch or whatever 100 times. But they had like Tyrann Mathieu on punt return. And they would just pull away from teams in the SEC every week without even being a very good offense. Because you couldn't score and they would slowly turn advantages and field position in their favor until they just beat you to death.
Like the classic Kansas State Bill Snyder teams that you and I admired.
Yeah.
They always felt like they were starting with the ball on the 45 on offense. And they always felt like you were starting with the ball on your 7 the whole game. And you never could just get out of that trap of field position. And those hidden yards do add up. And if you have a complementary play style to it, it can be very valuable. And I think special teams, I think people might be surprised to hear them cited as part of our level up, our optimist case. But I think it's going to be the margin in Texas having a 12-0 or 11-1 regular season versus 9-3 potentially.
Yes. Not only could they be very good at it and that make a big difference, but they were so bad at it last year.
Yes.
It's like the difference of like having, like in 2011, sorry, in 2021, when they had no one that could play edge, to 2022, when it was like Baron Sorrell and Ethan Burke. And neither of them were even great yet, but they were both like solid. And just going from god awful to solid made an enormous difference.
Sure does.
This will be like, this could be like going from Oviagufu or Jet Bush to like Colin Simmons. So,
yeah, it's like you and I are kind of, we're subscribers to the belief that I think I've said a few times, which is one of the keys to your O-line and one of the keys to your secondary is you want great guys, but have no weak link.
No weak links.
Have no guy that's sorry that could be specifically targeted, because you can have freaking Jadae Barron and Aaron Ross and Michael Huff out there. But if you've got one sorry dude in your secondary, the opposing offense can make him the story of the game.
Yes.
And I think it's like that in special teams. I also think with the upgrades of speed and athleticism, you know what we didn't do last year, Ian? We didn't block a freaking punt.
Duh. Yeah.
Every year that Jeff Banks has been here, we have blocked multiple punts and, in fact, changed games with those punt blocks. I think we're going to find our next Michael Taff to be the punt blocker. And it might be Michael Taff. But I think we might find our next Michael Taff in Jelani McDonald, in Jonah Williams, and guys like that that are just freaks with crazy get-off, length, instinct, anticipation. You load up with enough of those guys, you start to make those little plays on the margin that can really swing a game when you're playing OU, when you're playing at Georgia. Incredibly valuable. And speaking of our opponents, Ian, let's talk about that, because that's part of our story, our optimist case. Would you rather play the Ohio State Buckeyes in the opener or game 11?
Any other time. Any other time.
Any other time. Opener, yeah. I would rather play them in the opener than the third game. I think they'll be a different team.
Yes. Yeah. Do you believe they actually don't know who their quarterback is, or do you think that's just –
Julian Sayin is their quarterback. This is such nonsense.
I haven't asked anybody that I know in the Ohio State sphere, but
– You don't need to.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. It'll be his first start. I feel good about that game. If Ohio State takes it to Texas in that game, I'm probably less likely to come away saying, oh, wow, Texas is not what we thought, and more like, oh, crap, Ohio State is a buzzsaw. I can't believe they've already got this going like this early in the year.
My takeaway will be, oh, Saiyan is what they said, and I hope we don't see them in the playoffs. I hope someone can knock them off. But I think their most vulnerable moment will be that opener. Now, I would rather be playing them at a neutral or in Austin, Texas, but we're playing them where we play them. Sark has proven to be a good road warrior. Our teams have demonstrated good poise and composure on the road, which is a good sign of a good, well-coached football team that's sort of emotionally right. So that's good. Let's talk about Georgia.
Right after a bye week.
Right after a bye. Georgia, by the way, has the most amazing home schedule in college football. If you're a Georgia fan, congrats on your season tickets, because you're going to be seeing Alabama, Ole Miss, and Texas at your home slate. That's pretty awesome.
That's cool.
Also, if you're a Georgia fan, let's toughen up and get a little thicker skin. You're Georgia. Act like it. The other part of this is Gunnar Stockton. I love the scrappy, gutty winner, aspect of quarterbacking, but I also like scrappy, gutty winning guys who are really talented, because that's also an aspect of quarterbacking. Gunnar Stockton, I think we've seen him and probably not been blown away necessarily. I thought it was very telling when all of those NFL and college scouts and different people came back from the Manning camp, and they were raving about Arch Manning and his mechanics and how pure he is as a quarterback, raving about Lenore Sellers. Like, they've never seen a dude throw a football like that and built like a freaking NFL linebacker. Raving about Garrett Nussmeier's accuracy and touch and his sort of poise. Gunnar Stockton would come up and you'd hear the thing about Gunnar, he's a Georgia kid and it means a lot to him to play for Georgia. Kirby's got his guy. Interesting. Very interesting. Almost apologetic. And I was like, okay, so clearly he doesn't have this hidden skill set that he wasn't able to reveal. I think he is what he is, and he's got to be elevated by the supporting cast. Also, Georgia lost some real dudes on their defense. Now, it's Georgia. They're going to have a bunch of dudes to replace it. But I think that there is a very plausible world where not only we go into Athens and beat them, but I think Alabama goes in early to Athens and beats them as well.
Yeah, although that will put even more stakes on the Texas-Georgia game, which maybe not ideal for us since we'll be the visiting team. You know what I worry the most about with Stockton is decision-making. I think he's got a cannon arm. I don't know if he's super accurate or not. And he can run, and he's tough. But some of the decisions he made in that game against Texas, and it's like, well, this is his first time doing it. Well, he was also like a third or fourth year guy last year.
So, you know, to me, the more telling fault to decision making was Notre Dame. Because now his feet were wet. He had, 2 weeks, 3 weeks to prepare?
Yeah, I think so.
He went out there and, you know, he actually hit some throws that were open, that looked good. But in some other decision-driven areas of the game, boy, he looked real shaky.
Not a game manager.
He didn't play like a game manager, and he needs to play like a game manager for them to maximize.
Yes. Yeah. So that's heartwarming. Oklahoma sucks. We've talked about that a million times. The Florida game is a really tough draw, but if you're talking about a season where you play at Florida, at Georgia, and at Ohio State, and you actually feel like two out of three are pretty well placed,
yeah,
that's pretty good.
Well, and here's the thing that's interesting, Ian. One of the things that Texas fans are learning is that we are not the highlight of the season for every team that we play. And Texas fans don't like that, because they do kind of feed off the fact that this is their big, you know, Baylor's big game, fill in the blank, right? When we play Florida, hey, man, they want to pay us back. Yes, they know playing Texas is a big deal. Yes, it's the first time Texas goes to the swamp, blah, blah, blah. Dude, they play Florida State. They play Miami. They play Georgia. They play LSU at LSU. They got other stuff on their dance card. So, like, if you're imagining Florida is prepping Texas right now, you're living in a fantasy land. So, you know, that is kind of a what?
Maybe a little bit.
I mean, maybe, but the point is they got other games, man.
Yeah, these
games are just as meaningful. So I think that's kind of a thing that is helpful for us. Also, a road loss in the SEC ain't a killer. You know, that's the other part of this optimist case for Texas. I'll also go this far as schedule and how the playoffs fall. I'm not sure winning the SEC is necessary to position us correctly for the playoff. I think Texas making the playoff and playing good football at the end of the year is all that matters. And I think Ohio State taught us that last year.
Yeah, it's not like they got the easiest draw. They played Tennessee at home, which was not terrible, but not the easiest. Not SMU.
Yeah.
They played Oregon. They played Texas. That's not how you would draw up, here's how we're going to win the national championship, you know?
Well, I mean, as I said, I thought they won the national championship in the semifinal. When they beat Texas, I thought Ohio State had won the Notre Dame game. Before they even suited up. Notre Dame made it live at the end a little bit. That's nice. Ohio State was up 31-7 at one point.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I think Texas people are like, oh, you know, Sark needs to get over the hump. It's like Texas played for the national championship. It just happened in the semifinal.
Yeah.
So anything we want to add to the optimist case for Texas? What about continuity? The fact that we've had the same head coach, the same defensive coordinator, the same offensive coordinator for 5 years. Not many other teams in college football can say that.
Always helps.
Always helps.
Always helps. The defensive staff is particularly good at collaboration, probably owing to PK and the way he likes to do things.
Yep.
I think it seems like they've had guys come in and have obvious influence on the defense. So part of you is like, what is PK even doing? Well, one thing he's doing is he's allowing guys to come in and have influence that is positive. So that's clearly helpful. And then maintaining an overall structure that where guys can continue to grow every year. So that's been great. Overall, do you think, have you talked yourself into Texas a little bit more over this 40 minutes? Or are you still like?
I think it's all there. I mean, I think the ingredients are there. You don't have to go to these big leaps of faith to see Texas being an extremely good football team.
Yeah.
And the truth is, we just need to be better than everybody else. We don't have to be 2019 LSU, 2005 Texas, 1995 Nebraska to win it all.
Right.
Just be real good and play well in the playoffs. You know, one thing I'll close on that I love that we did in the offseason, Ian, we built out our analyst staff and we built out some of our special assistant coaches really intelligently. I love the guys that we brought in to collaborate in the defensive backfield. I love the pass rushing specialist that we brought in solely to work with those edges that we talked about, including Trey Moore and Anthony Hill. They're going to get their time at edge along with Brad Spence. And I really love a guy that people have forgotten about, who was brought in, and I know a little bit about him from our Big 12 days and writing up my prospectus, Neil Brown. Neil Brown is a guy who I think was not treated particularly fairly at West Virginia, given what he did with what the talent they had. But what I know about him is he has a great coach's eye. And what I mean by that is head coaches in general have a great eye for detail or things that look wrong or off, just broadly. And to have a coach like that who can just wander around your practice and then go to Sark and say, hey, make of this what you will, but the last 3 days, I don't like our pad level on the offensive line when we're running duo.
Yeah.
And Sark will go, okay, noted.
There have been questions too about whether Sark's offensive staff is it's not like PK and on defense where it's like everybody's got a big opinion. It's from what I've heard, it's more deferential to Sark.
Yes.
So to bring in a Paul Christ or a Neil Brown or someone like that, that'll come in and is not like intimidated or afraid to give an offensive opinion that's not out of Sark's pamphlet is probably very valuable.
It's very valuable for Neil Brown to discreetly go into Sark's office, shut the door and say, hey, man, your protection on counter gaps that we're doing play action, you're asking the tight end to block the play side edge. And I think that's garbage. I think when you play Georgia and OU, you're going to suffer for that decision. And Sark will go,
I guess that has happened and Paul has written about it. So
yeah, that's right. So I just think there's a lot of value, and I love the areas specifically that we brought in this extra staff. I think that they have tight focus, and then you brought in one generalist in Neil Brown who just wanders around practice and goes, hey, that guy, I don't know if you know this, but Kalik Lockett, the last 2 weeks, no one can cover him. You know, and I just think that's incredibly valuable to a head coach like Sark who has to juggle so much. So anyway, Ian, that has been our optimist case for Texas. I think we've tried to lay out some realistic upside scenarios for this Longhorn football team. We'll get back to our cynical and realistic perspective as soon as possible. But realize that part of the realism now of Texas football is that we're going to win it all. That's part of the realistic scenario for Texas football. And we haven't been able to say that for a while.
Yep.
With that enthusiasm, We would like to say thank you for joining us on the deep dive. Hey, make sure you go to Inside Texas. $1 gets you a membership until the kickoff with the Ohio State Buckeyes. And then, of course, buy the best damn Longhorn football preview, the Burnt Orange Bible, the 2025 Longhorn Football Perspectives, Thinking Texas Football, 61,000 words of burnt orange goodness. There's nothing like it out on the market. And y'all can find all the links to how to buy it in the description below, or just go to Amazon right now, go to Apple right now, or go to Smashwords right now and buy it for your e-reader. For Ian Boyd, I'm Paul Wadlington saying, hook 'em.